You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
And you know, if it were up to me, we'd be trolling on in every time. Now, we don't always troll on in, but sometimes, and we're going to do this today, we're going to be very far offshore. So I was telling you early in the program, PhD Dr. Mark Fitchett is with us, and he is new to the council, but certainly not new to the ocean. As a matter of fact, it's pretty interesting. And it's this time of the year where we roll forward and we start thinking of how's the stock of the big eye, how's the yellowfin, how's the ahi, where's our sashimi, what are we going to have for Christmas, and all of that stuff. And it's sort of funny because when the demand is there, the fish aren't. And when the fish are there, the demand isn't. And that certainly happened this last summer. We had more ahi and big eye than we knew how to shake a stick at. But in any case, it's a great way to study your favorite thing. And first of all, Mark, thanks for – nice seeing you again, because we got you in here certainly shortly after you got here.
Yep.
And now you've been with the council how long?
I've been at the council now going on 6 months now.
Yes, 6 months going on a century. And what I think is a lot of people don't get it, and that's why I always refer people to go to wpcouncil.org, because they can see what goes into this, you know, this bottoms-up management company in this organization. Before coming here, what did you know of the different regions of the councils?
Well, I knew of the councils. My experience had been in the Southeast. I knew more about the South Atlantic Regional Fisheries Management Council, the Gulf Council, working on projects on spiny lobster down in Florida. And then I have close friends who are council members up in North Carolina. They're they're commercial fishermen and recreational fishermen who are representatives. So I knew somewhat about the council process. We're a little bit unique out here because we cover so much area in that.
The geography of our district is huge, isn't it?
Yeah. It's huge out here, and as a more of an international and economic footprint than anywhere else. And tuna fisheries and pelagics are the greatest. Yeah. Pelagic fisheries in our region, a Compass X vessel at the dock alone is $110 million a year for Hawaii alone, not counting America, Samoa, and Guam, and CNMI.
Interesting enough when you say that is because we've often prided ourselves at the condition in which our fish are. They may not be the heaviest poundage, but they're the best quality.
So fresh fish.
So the dollar value of what we catch per pound must be higher than almost any other district.
It is higher. The only place that might come close is the New England bluefin tuna.
Of course.
And they're probably the highest, but they don't catch nearly as many as many tuna as we do here. We last year alone, according to NOAA, the X vessel landings for yellowfin were about $15 million and $72 million for big eye alone.
You know, here's what's interesting to me. As you know, we have the guys from the Wicked Tuna Show on all the time. And we have this kindred relationship because they're like us. And we don't understand how policed that area is. I mean, when they've reached their quota there, it's done. The boats just can't go out anymore, can they?
They know each other. They know whose boat's going where. Yeah, you know, they don't have as much ground open ocean as we do around us.
There's another thing too, and because of the way the show is compressed, you don't understand how long they're on the fish sometimes. In other words, it looks like boom, they catch it, and then they're putting the tail rope on it.
Yeah,
but I mean, in many cases, because of the gear and the size of the fish, it's hours.
It can be hours. Yeah. It can be a long time. Yeah. Even some of those Allison yellowfin tuna they get can take a while to get up to the boat.
Yeah. It looks to us when they bring them in, and they head them and they gut them and they tail them. Where's all that meat going? We think, don't be throwing that away. They're not throwing that away, are they?
Oh God, no.
Yeah, the cheek meat. Anyway, have you noticed a similarity between the fishermen? I mean, obviously those guys they got to catch that fish. They are, you know, and the rewards are terrific. Otherwise, they wouldn't keep going back at it. But aren't our guys kind of the same?
Yeah, I think from what I can, you know, surmise here, it's also there's more of a unique cultural connection with tuna and versus on the East Coast, it's mainly economic and local pride, just like it is here too.
Yeah, but it's generational there, and I'm not sure that we have the same challenges or anything, but I'm going to guess it's just as hard now to find people who want to get into that fishery at the labor end of it.
No, it's a lot of work.
It's pretty hard, isn't it?
It's
pretty
tough intense. Work.
Yeah. Yeah, they're out there for some time. And also, almost everybody thinks that that all that fish is being shipped off. And in fact, aren't there a tremendous amount of restaurants right there on the eastern seaboard that rely on that bluefin catch?
There's a good chunk that do stay in, and there's a restaurant market for it, you know, but also international as well.
Yeah, and they say that sometimes, just like here in the back in the day, that an airplane will be actually making passengers wait because the fish hasn't got into the belly of the ship yet. There are a lot of people that don't understand the difference between between the species. I mean, between the divisions of the species, like the difference between a yellowfin and a bluefin.
You mean this? You're talking about the speciation,
identification? Yeah.
Well, that has been an issue. I mean, that's an issue with big eye and yellowfin, the small big eye and yellowfin. And there's a scientist, actually a good friend of ours here in Hawaii, David Tano, who's done a lot of work on properly identifying, because some of those smaller big eye and smaller yellowfin before they get fat. And they grow that large Allison tail on a yellowfin when they're small. It can be a little bit difficult when they're within just a couple pounds, and so they can be there's room to be mis-ID'd.
Yeah, but you know the interesting thing about it, and I've heard this from many people, that these guys, particularly in Wicked Tuna, they know if it's a keeper or not right away. Our guys aren't that sophisticated because we don't have that size. We don't have that 73-inch, whatever it is, you know, that measurement. You gotta release them. It must be very, very difficult if you've had a fish on for a long time to even think, is this fish even going to make it if I release it?
Yeah. Yeah, and post-release mortality is a pretty important thing to really get a good grasp on.
Yeah, we're finding that too now in the corner crab and in other industries, right? You throw them back in because they're off-size, but they're not going to live. They're not going to get back down to the bottom again.
Oh, well, the Kona crabs, some of our contractors that did some work on Kona crabs actually found that most of those crabs were surprisingly pretty hardy and were different than the crabs, than the Kona crab equivalent in Australia. They're finding that
that's
they're actually
what I was going to ask you.
Yeah.
Yeah, because one of the things that they're saying is that our animals survive after losing parts.
Yeah, and they can even, and there's and evidence that they're even being able to regenerate. Yeah.
Wow, you know. That's not going to happen to us yet. Okay, so but making sure that people understand some of the global interests there are in these pelagics, particularly the tuna. I'm sure in Northern District you've heard how we will buy quotas from each other. We'll buy, you know, we'll negotiate for the getting to the total allowable catch out of an area.
Yeah, and that's an issue that we have the WCPFC meeting coming up, which is the Western Central Pacific Fisheries Commission, and you know one of our primary objectives, because here in Hawaii we have a pretty healthy stock, our catch rates are pretty high. We tend to meet our quota, so we are trying to increase that because the stock, according to latest stock assessment, the big eye tuna stock is doing fairly well based on some new biological information.
How do you differentiate? How does science differentiate between the migratory tuna and the local tuna? For instance, I think it's only recently that everybody's really come to agree that we have our own ahi in Hawaii.
Yeah, and there's been some studies, some tagging studies. Yeah. So with yellowfin and big eye, there's two schools of thought with yellowfin. And I'm glad you got into this because this is something that we had been I went to a meeting last month in New Caledonia for the tuna stock structure, and that was there's a major because tuna is the value of tuna is huge and intrinsic cultural value, but also economically here to Hawaii.
Sure.
How we manage and allocate tuna coming from our stock assessment information is very important. So, went to this meeting in New Caledonia. There's been past studies on yellowfin that show using microchemistry tracers on yellowfin that we most likely, more than they're almost certainly, that we have a local ahi stock. Mm-hmm. With big eye tuna right now, there's a lot of scientists in the scientific community are thinking that there's possibly a Central Pacific stock from the Line Islands in Hawaii.
That was previously not estimatable.
It was, or it was assumed that some go to the east and some go to the west. In the stock assessments, there's two major stock assessments and management schemes for Big Eye Tuna. We have the EPO, which is the Eastern Pacific, which is under the auspice of the IATTC, the Inter-America Tropical Tuna Commission, in La Jolla, and then the Secretariat of the Pacific Community in New Caledonia. So you have a Western Central and then an Eastern stock. And so what we're finding out and what a lot of scientists are thinking is that perhaps we have a Central Pacific Big Eye stock. And so we're actually in the works with some scientists in Australia to use genetic techniques to delineate stock structure of Big Eye tuna.
That would mean that we do DNA studies and that kind of thing.
Well, so there is a scientist down in Australia right now that I've been in contact with. So we're actually this winter we're going to get some tissue samples. We're looking for some smaller, younger Big Eye tuna. Mm-hmm. So we want to get a local genetic fingerprint of our fish here, caught within 50 miles and within 50 centimeters length. So some of these small Big Eye tuna. Because we are assuming that if they're that small, then they were most likely spawned or recently migrated
there
to Hawaii.
Yeah, yeah. That's the other thing. I think that long, long time ago, we used to think, we have to wait. We have to wait for the Japan current or the this or the that to bring us our tuna every year.
Yeah.
And then people start saying, wait a minute. You know, first of all, a lot of us can't tell the difference between a Big Eye and a yellowfin. And it's because, I guess, if for want of a better thing, it's the girth that we don't seem to have a grip on. I mean, basically, wouldn't you agree that almost everybody, even experts sometimes, when you look at a fish, it's hard to tell which one it is.
It is hard to tell. And I have to struggle to even myself, I mean, to when some of these, especially when looking at photos, you know, they were catching. I remember I saw on Facebook there were a fisherman down in Hilo who had caught a bunch of small Big Eye and yellowfin, and I was kind of being quizzed on, well, which one's a yellowfin and which one's a Big Eye.
Yeah, hard for me.
It is hard. Yeah. And so the coloration and the shape of the little finlets, sort of the sickle shape, shape of those fins is what are often used to determine. So it is tough because when they're young and they're small, they do look a lot alike.
Okay, that being said, what about the meat? I mean, I do know that a lot of people say, well, you really want the Big Eye over the Ahi. Is that true?
Yeah, a lot of people, for a lot of folks.
The oil or whatever.
A lot of folks do prefer Big Eye to yellowfin. Personally, if you're asking me, when my favorite is actually Aku. I love Aku.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you say that because I'm sure that you've known that most local people will tell you that that's not the common thought of non-local. Local people love the Aku because of the blood and the black. And everybody that's from other places says, I think I want the Tombo, the albacore. I want the white one. I don't want to see any black.
Yeah.
I don't see any blood.
Yeah, I don't think that way. Yeah. I love the Aku.
Yeah.
I like to go to down Bishop Street across from our office. The Aloha Poke Shop is the best.
There are, by the way, anecdotally, we could have a contest on who makes the best poke bowls, now that that's the big deal. But I still think that it's interesting because almost everybody says that Aku, you got to catch them and eat them today. They don't travel well. They don't last long. You got to get them in your boat and you got to get them to the market. Where some of the yellowfin and some of the Big Eye that comes in, it's 2 weeks old when it hits the floor of the auction.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some. I'm learning, talking to a lot of fishermen. I'm learning a lot more about the shelf life of some of these fish. But we're kind of lucky here in Hawaii because they catch lots of tuna. And we're able to get fresh fish here, and that's what is a very fortuitous benefit of being
and,
here.
Yeah, in many, many cases, and it's like you say. Especially at this time of the year, everything's expensive. But, you know, when you talk about Aku, people can afford it. You know, if the local guys, they can go out, you know, 3 miles offshore and catch a bunch of Aku and come home.
Yeah, and I have a friends of mine that, you know, have those trimaran sailing kayaks. Yeah. They go out of Waianae and they troll and they get, you know, little Aku.
Sure.
And you know, so that's pretty awesome.
Is it hard for them to make the traverse over deep ocean? I mean, you know, let's say even there were a lot of people who used to think that the Papahanaumokuakea was the nursery feeding all of these fish into the main Hawaiian Islands. But there's a lot of ocean in between there, and a lot of predation.
There's a lot of ocean. I think the...
And no food for some of them, right?
Right. Yeah. And I think there's a lot of local... There's a lot of conjecture on whether or not the monument area is providing, is a source for here in the Hawaii, in the main Hawaiian Islands. But skipjack tuna, according... When I was in New Caledonia, it surprised me that the average lifetime movement of skipjack tuna was about 33% more than yellowfin. So they actually displaced their annual their average lifetime displacement, which is pretty much how much these fish move in their lifetime, was actually greater for skipjack than it was for yellowfin. It's pretty substantially.
That's amazing. It is surprising, isn't it? Yeah, because they're smaller.
Yeah.
I mean, if you catch what they call the football, the otaro, the over 20 pounders, I think the record in Hawaii is 42 pounds. Which is a very big aku.
That's a big one.
Yeah, but I mean, more. You're talking about pan fryers. Aren't there a lot of people, Mark, that don't understand the difference between a pelagic and a non-pelagic fish? That the pelagics outnumber, it seems to me, the non-pelagics.
Yeah, I think that the lack of being able to make that distinguishment is. You know, I don't think the people here in Hawaii struggle to make that distinction. Yeah. I think a lot of folks elsewhere, because here, I think people are pretty in tune and what the pelagics are, and they know that, you know, you have your coastal pelagics, like your small fish, and you have your bottom fish, you have your reef fish, and you have your pelagics, because, you know.
I've always told people, when they say, what's a pelagic, I say, to me, that's a surface-running offshore game fish. I call them game fish because... You know, in tournaments, you think it's a game, but they're also, in many respects, because they were sought for, they're meat fish, you know, because they're bigger.
Oh yeah,
you know. Let's talk about some of the things. First of all, continuing on when you're in New Caledonia about the tuna, I'm glad you recognize, because we certainly know that it seems the further offshore from Hawaii and into the rest of the Pacific or Indian area you get more people that literally fish are currency. I mean, it's a lot different than here.
Yes.
Because here, if you can't buy fish, you go buy something else. There's stuff in a box. You buy something else.
Yeah, and especially when you get to the islands, there's a major food security issue here. And even in the United States, America, Samoa, the cannery is the largest employer. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of folks historically in that, even south of the equator, even within some of the U.S. Islands and territories, fishing was extremely important. It's a source of food security. And then some of these islands, especially in the South Pacific, you know, and food, fishes.
Well, we have a lot of examples here of people who go to places, whether it's Fiji, the Tuamotus, or wherever they go, where they literally have to ask somebody, can they go fish there? Because it is that compartmentalized with who gets to fish in that area for which species.
Yeah, and there's a lot in some of these islands, it can be it's a little bit different because there's cultural norms that you need to abide by. Yeah.
Interestingly enough, that all being said, we still have this way of working with each other. And I remember when we first met and talking about you had to develop a relationship with the local fishers to get anecdotal information that no matter what kind of science you're applying, you need to have the other stuff. You need to have it all.
Right. I mean, if you just sit there and rely on scientific literature or just the needs of what you're told, that which are what you need to be doing as a scientist, you're often fail to miss some of the really good ideas that can emerge, scientific ideas and hypotheses that can emerge by just talking to the fishermen themselves.
Do you get sometimes impressed at the amount of not just their tradition but culture that goes into this stuff and passing stuff forward and information? It would be pretty easy to have that chain broken. You know, just if one grandpa decided not to talk to anybody.
Yeah.
But fortunately, what's the most gratifying thing, I guess, and let me ask you this, is now that you've had a time to meet more and more of us, are you finding that people are willing and to be a little bit more open, not necessarily about trade secrets or some of the things that they'll never tell you, but just to talk in the first place instead of saying, oh, I don't want to do anything, you know, leave me alone.
I actually think here is kind of surprising me in general that the reception when I started working for council and talking to many in the fishing community, how open and friendly people are. Because in the, yeah, you see, you hit it right there. There's the trade secrets. And there's also a little bit of distrust of when you say, put the word fishery and management in one sentence. You tell
management
them,
gets me a little worried
sometimes. They get a little worrisome. Yeah. But I think here they realize that, you know, they have a unique resource here in Hawaii that they want to, they don't, folks here in Hawaii, I think, have a little bit more of a, of an end game when it comes to fisheries. Mm-hmm. They see a little bit further down the road. I think in places where you have a much higher a population and the business element takes over, I think people's perception of fisheries management is more short term.
Well, look what happened when the stock got dwindled so low back east that how many of those Gloucester and other Nantucket boats ended up in the Pacific. I mean, literally thousands of them.
Yeah, I'm sure some folks came over from the east. And right now on the East Coast of the ICAT, I don't know if folks have here been paying attention, it's worth putting an eye on. In the east right now in the Atlantic, the big ice stock has been grossly overfished.
Mm-hmm.
And so the United States is actually maintained a pretty, you know, decent, tough stance in the east, at least in the Atlantic, that, hey, this is not our doing.
How are they caught there?
They could. There's troll fisheries. There's also in the east, in the Atlantic, there's troll and longline.
Yeah, the troll that we saw are so different from some of our weekend warrior boats. I saw this one boat that had these outriggers that went out, side riggers, I really called them. And I think each one of them had four or five or six lines running from them. And when something would come up and take a bait or a squid or whatever was there, a lure or whatever, it would break off from the line, but the boat would just keep going. And let the thing and just bring it in right through what, like here we take in all our lines, we want to get everything out of the way so we can get that fish up the gaff. And I said, these guys just kept on driving.
Yeah, that's pretty
intense. And multiple
intense.
Hookups were common.
That's pretty intense. Yeah. And you know, they probably need to increase their fishing power as much as they can with what they have. They also use green sticks. And where I'm from in North Carolina, they actually have boats, which surprises a lot of folks. I tell them that they use green sticks there too.
Yeah, well, incidentally, and Neil, if you're listening from POP, a lot of these guys, the reason I got the Wicked Tuna guys to be on this program was because of the green sticks that they got from POP. A lot of those boats, especially the smaller ones, are coming through from Japan to here and then from here to the East Coast. So I mean, the green stick, there are an awful lot of people that have the POP t-shirts on. If you go down and see some of those boats, you'll see guys wearing the Hawaii shirts all over the place. They know.
Yeah, and the green sticks, when I was in doing my PhD work down on billfish tagging, a lot of the boat, one of the boats we were on had a what they call a palo verde, which is a green stick or green tree, but actually theirs are purple, like very bright. Purple in color. And they have them on a lot of their boats down there too. They're putting on, because you know, there's a lot of there's the opportunity to catch a lot of nice size tuna, or as they call it down in Costa Rica, the tico tuna, you know, because they're trying to open
By the way, let's talk about that for a minute, because those of you that don't know, we can't paint the mind's eye, but you can go to POP. You can go to wpcouncil.org or the POP site and see illustrations of how the green sticks work. It's this big, tall stick, 30, 40, sometimes higher, and it goes, there's a wooden bird or a wooden item way, way behind your boat, 100 yards behind your boat, and all these lines that are dangling, right? So as the boat goes through the water, the baits or whatever are splashing, and up come the tuna and grab them, and then now they're hooked.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see. It's not very easy to deploy, but
They're pretty dangerous, but once you get a pretty good handle on it, it's pretty good. So, but it's interesting when you say you saw that back east. What about in other places like New Caledonia and places like that? I don't see as many green sticks outside of Hawaii as we do in the rest of the Pacific.
Yeah, New Caledonia is a little bit different. They don't have the type of tuna fishery we have. Period.
Yeah.
In New Caledonia, their fisheries are a little bit different. They have a large lagoon and barrier reef around, which is pretty interesting. And I learned something when I was there too. There's a unique fishery out there, which was fascinating. They go out on these small boats, and they have what looks like a motorcycle helmet on the boats and with a big light. And they were scooping up flying fish. So they go out at night. At night, and then turn on. It looks like they're wearing a motorcycle helmet with these big, huge 2 million candle of lights they turn on, and the flying fish will come. And it was interesting. That was pretty cool.
Maybe they need the helmet because otherwise the flying fish will hit them in the head.
Apparently they load up a boat.
Yeah. So that's what's interesting to me. First time I went down to whether it was Majuro or Chuuk or Palau, I can't remember. Their reel was in their hand. They didn't have rods. They didn't have drags. They didn't have anything. They're hand lining aku, the big ones. They're hand lining tuna. But I still think that people don't get it when they make a conscious effort here to buy a fish. How much different our fish in our market is from where you came there. They just go from the boat to a bucket of ice on the side of the road or to the grocery store.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. And there is a major difference between that could be said from wherever, everywhere you go.
Well, remind me again, and by the way, Dr. Mark Fitchett is, for one of the pelagic guy at the council. Now, what's the title? What is the title that comes with it?
So my title is Pelagic Fisheries Ecosystem Scientist. Mm-hmm. And so I work with scientists from the international community here at NOAA and working with folks pretty much all over, oceanographers. Mm-hmm. My purview is looking at managing some projects that fall within our pelagics research plan. So we have a lot of research projects, anything from looking at stock indicators of some of our locally incidental caught species, shark research plan, things like that. Yeah. And then also participating in their review and a lot of actual science that goes into assessing some of these species.
And by the way, gang, Mark will be back next week. And in that program next week, we're going to talk a little bit about what he just mentioned, that sharks, not just the finning and the tailing, but what sharks are doing to the catch. And to me, it seems like we'll get into this next time a little bit in more depth. But even sharks are pretty smart. They're predators, and they know they're eating machines. So they pretty much know if you follow around that thing over there, that boat, you're likely to get a bunch of free fish.
Yeah.
And they just come up and just suck. I can tell you, being on the grounds off in Kona, people can't believe how porpoise are so clever. They will come up behind your bait. You're trolling an aku or something, and they will take that fish right from the gill plate back and never get caught, never get hooked.
Nope. And they're the tax man.
Yeah. You pay the price. Okay, so let's get you back from New Caledonia. To recap, the purpose of the New Caledonia trip was?
So the purpose of the New Caledonia trip is we were meeting with scientists throughout the entire Pacific, including some folks with a Conservation International, which are interested in the governance of tuna fisheries. We are meeting with the Secretariat of the Pacific Community, which is the science provider for Western Central Pacific tuna stocks. Mm-hmm. And we also had a scientist from the Eastern Pacific. So the idea was putting folks together and coming up with ways to develop a Pacific-wide research plan on how we're going to tackle some of these uncertainties on where we draw our lines when we do our stock assessments.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Because of that, I guess the hardest thing to agree on is how many fish are out there and who should be allowed to catch what.
Yeah, and that's where it goes from a lot of the science, hard science, into the political and the social aspect. So one of the major issues is, how many of fish that are caught here in Hawaii originate or are spawned or are part of the spawning population in the Eastern Pacific? How many are attributed to the Western Central? How many perhaps we have our own? And so how are we going to manage that? If we have a different stock delineation that is shared under the purview of the IATTC in the East and the SPC in the West, how do we deal with that?
Yeah,
and there's many things that you...
It's kind of like, Doc, isn't it, what we were talking about before on the ahi, on the yellowfin tuna. 20 years ago, it was really hard to tell people that we had our own. Everybody was waiting for them to come in every year. Well, they were here.
Yeah.
We were just not catching them. They were doing other things besides coming in near the shore so we could hook them.
They might have been down in the Line Islands. Yeah. They might have been where we're not fishing. They might have been outside the range of where we're fishing. About 7% of our fish here in Hawaii from our longline fleet, both shallow set and deep set. About 7% are caught east since the mid-90s. 7% have been caught east of the 150 west line, which is...
Which tells you a lot, right?
Which that most of them are caught, with pretty close to Hawaii, but also more in the western, within the western and central stock group.
Would it be availability of nutrients, food? What would determine one place being more populated than another?
Well, I mean, food, there's always, you know, I had a professor at NC State that said there's three things that drive an animal, a population. That's food, sex, and death.
Yeah.
So
in that order, probably.
In that order. Yeah. So here in Hawaii, we have what's called the island mass effect. So and within currents, when you have these currents that push through in the Pacific Ocean, they create these wakes where you get these eddies, a lot of food. It's kind of hard to describe over the radio without, you know, drawing it on the board, but it's really a lot of these fishermen here know that.
A lot of people, I'm glad you said that, Mark, because a lot of people, their rubbish line or current line, and there's something magic almost always. If you can stick with that line, you're going to catch fish because there's something magic about that. Is a sign of something else going on under the water.
Right. And it's like, you know, it's like you tell folks, you know, when I explain to kids, like when you're in a swimming pool or a bathtub and you drag your hand on the water, you push that water. If you notice, there's a lot of swirl. There's a lot of eddies or vorticity or activity in the water column. What happens is a lot of food and
little stuff is in there.
It gets trapped in these, or they get caught in these eddies and these meanders, and these fish, the fish know this.
I think that's why they can open their mouth so much, because they get right into that eddy and they just vacuum whatever's in the water there.
Yeah, a lot of food.
But it really is to me amazing at how much food there is out there, because when you take a look at the big deep ocean and you know that you have little fish that are near the surface that are traversing hundreds or maybe even thousands of miles, what are they eating? Well, what they're eating is a lot of stuff, but literally they have to eat the whole time they're awake, I would guess.
Yeah.
They got to find food.
There's a lot of, and the small pelagic, small fish are very important and are very pivotal. You know, you have the scads, the apelu, and the kule, which are really, really, really important here to Hawaii.
You know, it's funny you say that, because every now and again we get into the debate on the show. Are they bait fish or food fish? Well, they're both.
A little bit of both.
You know, yeah. And here, when you go to get bait, when you get these boxes of Saba or Sanmar or whatever you buy at the bait store, they kind of look like a coolie, they kind of look like Opelo, but they're all frozen up and you wouldn't eat them, but they sure catch a lot of fish.
Yeah. I've been wanting to go out in one of those boats out on the west side and go watch how they catch them. It's pretty neat. Bait fish are important in Miami. When I was living in Miami, and we had a place that was called the Fowey Rocks, and we would drop a bunch of sabiki rigs and catch goggle eyes. We've catched more goggle eyes than we know what to do with.
About the size of an opelo, right?
Right, yeah. and they're like candy to small billfish,
sure. Especially
and tunas,
sailfish,
especially down there. And you know, at one point, people weren't catching any, so it made fishing pretty hard. And I remember during a tournament, just hearing, talking to some friends of mine, they were selling them for about $100 a dozen.
Oh, Jesus, $8 a pop. Wow.
Yeah.
But here's the other side of it. And I know that we play the greatest fishing band in the world, the Doradas. I play some of their music on this show. And they talk about they're fishing the West Coast, and they pull out of San Diego and they go by a bait station and buy two scoops.
Yeah.
You know, and people didn't know what he meant. It's a huge, big scoop net full of live fish that are right there for the fishermen. You don't have to go catch them, you go buy them.
Yeah, I'm really interested. You bring that up, Mike. I'm really interested about right now in California, especially in Southern California, they're seeing signs of El Nino right now. And
big change in the fishery.
Big change in fishery.
Right,
they're seeing a lot of those red tuna crabs in California. There's pelagic crabs that usually is a telltale sign that, hey, things are about to heat up. And with bluefin tuna is a big issue right now, and some of these small tunas, there could be seeing some pretty good catch rates for tunas. And then of course, when you get these climatic events, they get those giant squid too, which can be kind of a nuisance.
Yeah. Here, by the way. If we get some of them here, we'd love them. There was an interesting story in the paper the other day. Maybe we can talk about that next week a little bit. A big drop in the whale sightings. And they're saying maybe some of that is because of food disruption. You know, because that's what happens when you, if they don't have to come here for, if their water up near Alaska is warm enough and there's food, why bother to come all the way to Hawaii? They just stay home.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, that's, I hope you get sort of a bird's eye view there on some of the stuff that Mark does. One thing I'd like to do is come is next week, is talk not just about the pelagics that we've talked about, now the tuna, but some of the other fish that people may not consider as pelagic. You mentioned one off the air before we got talking. I'd like to chat a little bit about opa.
You know,
I think that's just delicious. A wonderful fish. Okay. So anyway, like I said, Mark will be back next time. And in the meantime, if you have something that you want to hear on the program, you know what to do. You drop me a line, themikebuckshow@gmail.com. Themikebuckshow@gmail.com. And if you want to know more about what Mark and I are talking about, well, go to our favorite place, wpcouncil.org. Wpcouncil.org. And like I said, if you want to hear something on the show or you want to submit a story, drop me the line at themikebuckshow@gmail.com. Have a nice rest of your weekend. We'll see you next time.